I know you couldn't wait, and I know you were on the edge of your seat for another riveting episode of Common Sense Ohio. It is July 15, 2026, brought to you, of course, by Harper Plus Accounting. You know, I was just doing some accounting work upstairs, but believe it or not, I get up early. And I was doing some accounting work upstairs, trying to figure out the nuances of my company's 401k plan. And it said, you want to send this information to anybody else? I was like, yes.
Yes.
Send it over to Glenn Harper at Harper Plus Accounting, because no matter what I screw up, no matter what I met, what I don't know, they will fill in the blanks. Our accountant could be yours. July 15 in history, two really, actually lots of, I Google this every time, and there's, sometimes it gets sort of boring.
Right.
But not today.
Okay.
You know, we had two pretty significant things happen on July 15. The First Crusade, or Jerusalem falls in the First Crusade, 1099.
Okay.
Just, there's some interesting history there.
Yeah.
You know, Jerusalem fell about 450 years before that, in sort of a peaceful conquest by the Muslims. And they had a treaty that basically said, look, you Christians, you can practice your Christianity. And they gave up the city. And they even, and then the Muslims even gave up, or left made room for the Jews to come in and do their thing.
Yeah.
Well, that slowly eroded over the next 450 years, and things got really horrible. So the Pope says, we need to go help out down there. And offers all the knights salvation. So look, you want some salvation? I'll give it to you. All you got to do is go fight this war and take back Jerusalem. And eventually in 1099, they do it.
Yeah.
That is a truncated version of history.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it, of course, changes over the years. The Crusades are used for all sorts of other reasons. But
yeah, yeah. I think history. A lot of it was also to protect pilgrims who Correct. Were being exploited and killed and robbed.
Yeah.
En route, you know, when they were traversing from, say, Turkey or Europe or somewhere to Jerusalem to see, you know, all of the holy sites in Christendom, they, you know, that was another one of the Pope's motivations, I believe.
That was the reason for the, because what happens is we had this peaceful existence where the Christians could go make pilgrimages to Jerusalem to see all the holy sites and check it out and do what they do.
Right.
But then comes the Seljuk Turks, who are a new sort of radical, recently converted group of Muslims, who they say, nonsense, if you're not with us, you're dead. Mm-hmm. And they started cutting off the pilgrimages. They started killing it. They changed the treaty.
Right.
So the peaceful existence.
Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Yeah, that's right. So those of you remember Falco, maybe. So there was a disruption in the pilgrimages. There was a Byzantine cry for help.
Yeah.
And Pope Urban II basically offers salvation to the knights. And apparently this was almost beneficial to the knights, because we had this feudal system in the West, in France, in England. And
it united a lot of European.
Yeah. They're running out of people to fight.
Yeah.
So they're fighting each other.
It was like a preview of NATO in a way, because, you know, you're banding together Germans, Brits, Frenchies, Italians. People who would otherwise be fighting amongst themselves were joining together under the papal banner to do a single thing, which, you know, is fascinating.
And as I like to, there's one other thing that happened. We don't need to dig into it.
Yeah.
But I do. It's interesting. What you just said gave me a thought that I want to get back to. But before I do that, the Rosetta Stone discovered.
That's big. Yeah.
And that
with three different languages on the same stone.
Yeah, 1799. Basically, again, another hallmark of ancient history and Christianity. And as a result,
was that a Napoleonic? Was he in Egypt when that was found?
A French soldier, Pierre Francois Bouchard, in the town of Rosetta, in the Nile Delta. He found it while troops were digging the foundations of a fort during Napoleon's campaign in Egypt.
Okay. Yeah. So sometimes,
Egyptian hieroglyphs, demonic and ancient Greek, all in one place.
Yeah.
And opened up the key to the ancient world.
Yeah. Yeah. Really was a cipher. To break these codes. Hitherto unreadable.
Yep.
Pretty cool stuff. Now they're using AI, from what I understand, to accelerate things like, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls and other things that they haven't been able to, like, piece together where the missing chunks are, or understand Sanskrit, some of these ancient languages. They're evidently we're able to speed this up. So I hope it does a better job than it is doing on term papers for some of their college kids, you know.
Well, so. Well, look, I want to get back to the thought you gave me, because my mind is like, here, a secret. I have a little bit of ADHD.
Okay.
Right?
So no.
Imagine that.
No, not Steve.
But I've always got like 10 movies playing in my head in different directions, and I'm trying to find parallels and connections between them. And what you just said gave me a thought. You said the Crusades, or the First Crusade, unified in a way.
Yeah. Common enemy
for a cause.
Yeah.
And if you fast forward a few thousand years until like today.
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is that you and I grew up, you're older than I am, obviously.
Obviously.
No, but our generation, we had a common enemy. You know, we grew up and the Soviets were the bad guys.
Yeah.
They were going to blow us off the planet.
Reagan's evil empire.
Evil empire. We used to hide under our desks for the
duck and cover.
Yep. And we had little fallout signs everywhere in our schools.
Civil defense, you know, underground shelter signs on public buildings.
All the movies.
Yeah.
All the
Dr. Strangelove.
Really. I mean, that's a little bit, I don't, when was that? I don't know when that came out, but probably before my time. But I've watched a movie, and I grew up on a movie. And then in the 80s, all the movies, the action movies were like, you know, Rambo fighting the evil Russians.
Red Dawn.
Right.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to this sort of gen whatever we're in. They didn't have that.
No.
And they don't see it. Now, look, you could, they would say, I think, well, you guys were skewed. You didn't understand how you were all just brainwashed by this evil thing. And even
you should have been nicer to Mr. Khrushchev.
Right, who wanted to blow us off the planet. And who killed, you know, how many, 80 million people.
But you should have tea with Mr. Brezhnev. You know, you just didn't relate to him enough. You know, you were heads.
They think we're askew. Yeah. And we think you guys don't know what you're grappling with here.
Yeah.
It's like.
Oh, for sure.
You know, there's a caution sign, like, and they don't have a context for it. There's a giant caution sign right in front of them. They've stumbled upon a caution sign, and they're looking around like, I don't see anything wrong with it. Why don't we just go forward?
Right.
And the caution sign that we know is that we learned the history of what that ideology did to the world.
Yeah.
And they don't have it.
Huh?
We had a common enemy. And United States, for all its flaws, for the most part, in 1976, when we had that anniversary, was unified.
Yeah.
You know, we hated each other.
Right.
You know, there was arguments, there was protests, Vietnam was a mess and all of it.
Sure.
But I remember as a kid marching in the parade, and there was at least patriotism then.
Yeah, and there were quite serious problems. I mean,
almost bigger than what we have now.
Right? Oh yeah, I mean, President Ford had pardoned Richard Nixon for Watergate. We had thousands, tens of thousands of Vietnam draft dodgers in other countries that later on President Carter would pardon. So there were the scars of Vietnam were very raw.
Mm-hmm.
We had that embarrassing scene at the embassy in Saigon with the helicopters taking the last few people away. And of course, our allies, the South Vietnamese, were just left behind to deal with the communists who took over the country after violating the peace treaty that Kissinger had negotiated with Le Doc Tho. So, yeah, the country, it
things economically were disastrous.
Oh, you know, yeah. Remember Ford?
Remember these policies?
There was a button you could get during Ford's administration. It said WIN, which was whip inflation now, because interest rates were off the scale. Inflation was crazy. OPEC was strangling us on oil.
Gasoline lines.
It was a mess.
If you wanted to get gasoline for your car, you had to wait in line.
Yeah.
I mean, I was only, I was born in 1970, so a lot of this, I was only like six or seven, 8 years old, but I do remember this stuff.
Yeah, and Ford did not win the election. You know, he came in as Nixon's vice president when Nixon resigned. He was never elected president, and Carter beat him, you know, in the upcoming election. So, and people were, you know, you had the Charlie Manson girls take a few assassination shots at President Ford. Yeah, it was madness.
It was a mess.
Society was a mess, but still in all, during the bicentennial of 1976, that's the year I graduated from high school, remember it well because, you know, that was my big year. And they even made a movie, Dazed and Confused, about that summer. And so I can relate to all that. And there's a GTO in that movie, by the way, which both of us. But at any rate, people understood that we were still one country. And there were in the loyal opposition at that time, the Democrats who controlled Congress in the wake of Watergate, they threw the Republicans out. They still loved their country. They still understood the merits of capitalism, you know, and they, yes, they were pro-union, but they didn't want to destroy the economy and bring in socialism. They knew that wasn't going to work. So, things today are really.
And the only people that remember it are like, we remember it, but we didn't live it.
Yeah.
But then you've got the people that are coming over.
Yeah.
Like the people that used to live in Cuba.
Sure.
All the migrants from former communist / socialist regime.
Yeah.
Regimes.
Yeah.
Are saying, what in the F are you guys tinkering with here? There's this caution sign.
Yeah.
Heed it.
Yeah.
Right. Like
yeah.
It is, you know, the stove is hot, but I think I heard Dennis Prager, you know, he's been injured and he's had some issues.
Yeah.
But this was a recent comment. He just says, and he made a point and he just said, look, it seems like every generation or every 100 years, somebody, we have to tinker with this again and realize how horrible it is.
Yeah.
And then go back. I mean, it's like this cycle.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Cuba's a good example. Venezuela's a good example. At one time, before Chavez came in and tried socialism there, imposed it for many years and his successors. Venezuela had this just bursting economy. Yeah. It was just doing so well. The rate of savings by Venezuelans exceeded savings of people in the United States. They were socking money away. They were doing well. And, you know, now they're starting to get back to that again after throwing. And obviously we helped with the capture of Chavez. But,
it's almost like it doesn't
happen. Or Maduro, excuse me.
It doesn't happen when times are bad.
Yeah.
It only happens when people are fat and happy.
Yes.
I don't know that to be sure. I have to do some thinking on history on the Russian Revolution. But in modern times, these countries tend to, there tends to be this shift to socialism.
Yeah.
Our country's no different.
Yeah.
When we're fat and happy.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and these kids are complaining, but look, they're complaining on their iPhones and they're complaining in their, we are fat and happy by all measures. Historically, we're fat and happy.
Yeah.
Some are fatter and happier than others, but we are generally fat and happy. I mean, nobody, we're not living on dirt floors.
Yeah, what is considered suffering today are things like, we don't have a big screen TV as big as the one that the Smiths down the street have. Or
you've got a whole home theater in your basement, Norm. How fair is that?
Yeah, that's
not this little TV here.
Yeah, or I've got Dad's old flip phone, because he won't buy me an $1,800 iPhone 17 or whatever the latest one is. Yeah, I mean, what people consider struggling today would truly make Americans of even 50 years ago just laugh out loud. Mm. When like a starter home back then might not even have a fully finished basement. Most didn't. Or even plumbing downstairs. Like, didn't have a toilet or a shower downstairs. But now, of course, every home's a McMansion it's uninhabitable. How can I move in there? There's not an extra 3 bedrooms for when I invite my girlfriends over, for a girls party or wine mom thing or something. It's like everything, I heard, for example, that people are driving like cars that are way more expensive, of course, than they used to be. You know, when I was in high school or college or even as a young adult, I was buying, $1,000 banger cars and I was fixing them up myself, doing brake jobs on them myself. And now, kids, either they don't have the skills or they're not interested, but they want to go right into a dealership and buy a new car.
Yeah.
And if they can't do it financially, they feel somehow they're being oppressed.
And what's interesting
is, like, work your ass off like the rest of us.
You know, by all measures, I grew up upper middle class. I'm not going to, you know, I had a good, my, you know, knock on wood, thank the Lord. I had a good upbringing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we didn't buy new cars every 2 years.
No.
You know, it was like every 12 years or 10 years, and they were rust buckets, and you know, but nobody really thought about that. You know, it was just like, you know, it was the Pinto was the Pinto.
A lot of the people back then, Steve, that would buy new cars every 2 or 3 years were people who had a financial reason to always drive a spanking new car, like salesmen or realtors or people who were putting clients, or they wanted to have that appearance of success when they pulled up to the curb, and they needed to have that image, right? But the rest of us, it was just transportation.
Yeah, it was like a 10-year deal. You had a car for 10 years. And I now I drive a car that's, or I have a 2011 Toyota Tundra.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, you know, 15 years old.
Yeah, I drive a 2015 Ford Ranger.
And it's
ho-hum.
And the reason that cars lasted 10 years is because they only lasted 10 years. They only lasted. They started to fall apart.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. You know, it's like, I don't know what that we've upped the standard so
we've
much
upped
here.
That's right.
That people don't understand the bottom.
Yeah.
And we're going to, I fear, and then I'll let you get onto the news, but I fear I fear the worst, that we're going to have to go experience the bottom again by going to socialism to see what that really means and what that really is. Because if you think that it's going to be, if you think that your government is going to give you a McMansion, like your parents have, you're mistaken.
I think so. Feeding in that leads into one of the news items, and it's not particularly a sizzling thing, you know. And but to me, it's controversial, and that is on July 4th, in his speech on the Mall. President Trump, you know, rolled out several programs that, in his way of thinking, you know, are advances. And one of those is socialistic in nature. And it just drives me nuts. And it's this Trump children's account of $1,000 starter money to get children invested into the stock market. You know, get a 401k type of plan going for their retirement, and get them. I know, so even Bessent is in favor of this, his Treasury Secretary. But so I know what the intention is. It's actually to demonstrate the merits of capitalism. But the way you're doing it is by just giving money. So to me, it's like, okay, so Trump kicks this program off. Every newborn can apply for a Trump account and get $1,000 to start it. And then, you know, you're just like, well, the next administration, if Mamdani becomes president or AOC, they're just going to make that, what, $5,000?
Right.
Or $10,000. Like, why are you just giving somebody money because they're born? I don't get that.
As I've always said, if everybody has the same, then it's meaningless.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, it's just not human nature. So if think how boring society would be.
Yeah.
Some homogenous, everybody has identical stuff,
right?
Identical amount of money.
Right.
They have the identical
right.
car. Cause that's really what this is. I mean, cause right. that's where social, I went to Estonia in the '90s.
Yeah.
And it was after the fall of the Soviet Empire or the Soviet regime. But there's a lot of expat Soviet Russians there.
Yeah.
And you could see the parts of the city that were old Soviet burgs. And they would stack these, like, they would make walls out of concrete, and they would take cranes, it looks like. I don't know how they built them. But they were just boxes of concrete
absolutely.
Walls. Straight up.
Right.
And then you had, like, these old, these old Estonian villages or housing in the center village. I mean, it's gorgeous stuff, like walking streets of brick.
Sure.
I mean, gorgeous, beautiful city.
Yeah.
And then sort of flanked by these awful, ugly ass Soviet era housing.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
That's
it's
right.
It's not like everybody gets the really cool stuff. It degrades to everybody gets the crap.
Yeah. So all men are created equal, right? That's in the Declaration of Independence. And what's Trump say on the Mall? And this is us being critical of Trump, by the way. So we're, you know, we're generally very conservative.
This is buying votes, right? This is, well, I can't even say it. I don't know what this is, but it, I don't agree with it.
Yeah. I mean, to me, so all men are created equal. That doesn't mean the government goes in and tries to balance out inequalities. That's not the purpose of government, in my opinion. And another thing, now Trump, he didn't sign this housing bill that he was himself in favor of because the Save America Act wasn't passed. So in a fit of pique, he has decided, well, I'm not signing the housing bill that he himself was pushing for. And what is the housing bill that you know, Congress will override that? There, you know, it's wildly popular. And what it is basically says big corporations can't buy houses because somehow they're going to control the real estate market. Well, that's been going on since the beginning of time.
Yeah, you just can't control it that
way. I mean, there was something called the Ohio Company, right? Before Ohio was even a state, the Ohio Company owned vast tracts of the Northwest Territory before we were even a state. And so there's always been big companies owning real estate and trying to control growth and trying to dictate, you know, where the cities are going to be and where the farms are going to be and all of that. And now it's data centers. So, you know, I'm far more interested in what the natural market forces would do with housing. And it seems to me when you prop up housing prices, you're again making it less and less affordable for young people. And I know their intention is to keep the companies from buying these properties and then refurbing them or flipping them, right, for more money. But, you know, if enough companies do this, just like when they were overbuilding fiber optic, it backfires. Fiber optic became incredibly inexpensive because too many companies went into it. And if too many companies think that they're going to flip houses and sell them to people who don't have the money to buy it, guess what? Housing prices will crash.
It will fix itself.
It will fix itself.
So instead, what we're doing is in New York, like Mondami, he has put insane regulatory requirements on owners of housing.
Yes. Landlords. You can't even have two houses and not have to pay extra because you have a second place.
And at the same time, he is putting rent controls. So not only do you have to meet the new regulatory requirements, then you have rent controls. So you can't do it financially. And that's all just a means to justify the government coming in and say, look, we have to take over because
you're right. You haven't been paying your taxes.
These people are so horrible that they're not doing it for you. So we're just going to do it for you. So now the government owns.
Or we're going to condemn your
private property. Right. Yeah. We're going to condemn the property. The government's going to take it. Now the government owns it and no worries. What could possibly go wrong? Because the last time the government maintained housing, it was always successful, right?
Yes. Like all the Section 8 housing they're knocking down here in Columbus, all the public housing projects that they're going to level here, you know, because, well, they can't control what's going on inside. They can't control the crime. And really, Steve, it's a refusal to control the crime. The police know, and the feds know, just like these ICE shootings, they know how to address crime. The public doesn't have the stomach for it. And you see that at curfews, at malls, you know. Well, let's just shut the mall down because we can't enforce the curfews because that'll upset people. So then the quality of life in your city stinks and people move out to the suburbs and they bring their attitudes, you know, out into the suburbs and the cycle continues again because now the crime wave goes to the suburbs. Guess what? You know, we go to where the goodies are. That's where we do the crime. So if the goodies are going to be in the suburbs, the crime follows.
Guess what? So that means they're knocking on your door.
Yeah.
That means they're knocking on your door.
Yeah.
And the problem, I mean, look, getting rid of the cops, when has that ever worked?
Yeah.
When has it ever worked?
Right.
It doesn't.
And you got the candidate for the Senate in Michigan, this doctor, this radical Islamicist, running for Senate in Michigan has said, well, we need to de-weaponize the police. They don't need guns. And then let's shrink the departments because rather than policing what he calls poor people, he associates crime with being poor, and which I don't, because I know a lot of rich people commit crimes. So it's not, you know, crime is not the purview of poor people. There are many honorable, law-abiding poor people. So I don't know what, you know, but this is a socialist mindset.
You have to tie it to that. Yeah,
exactly. And so, well, we'll take all that money that's going for, you know, bullet vests and guns and police retirements and pensions. We'll take all of that money and we're going to spend it on, you know, building government, I don't know, villages.
Departments.
And have government.
Administrative groceries. Something or other, right?
I mean.
So then you take the money, you put it up here, you take your money.
Right.
You stick it up here.
Yeah.
And with the promise that we're going to give it to the people that we know best how to
right.
spend your money.
Right.
But then they're going to filter it through all their cronies.
That's right.
It's got to get filtered through these giant departments of whatever.
Correct.
That employ hundreds of people
Correct.
At six-figure jobs
right.
to decide how to use your money, because we have to do that fairly.
Right.
And then by the time your money gets from here to here, it's down to hardly anything.
Yeah.
And then the only solution is not to do all this. It is to take more of your money.
Yeah.
And the process continues.
And like we talked about in a previous show, people like Karen Bass or this guy running for Senate, they don't really care about the depopulation of their area, because they're getting down to the core group of people who benefit from this largesse. And it's just a self-feeding system. So, you know, why bring in a guy like Spencer Pratt, who's going to blow up the system and really fix LA, or try to fix LA? No, just keep LA the cesspool that it is. Yes, people are moving out. They're leaving California in droves. But the people left behind are the people who are dependent on Karen Bass. And so the system is self-perpetuating.
Yep.
You know, because you've gotten rid of the troublemakers, i.e. the people who have income. So you're left with, you know, you're left with people who are either intentionally or inept in some way, and they're totally dependent on government to survive. And, you know, the more that happens, the more that people, you know, people with money are not stupid. And at some point they pull up stakes and leave.
Well, that's happening, right?
And they empty it out.
I saw the number of millionaires now, or the people of X net worth have now left New York City.
Yeah. It's terrible for New York.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah. So, at any rate, one of the other disturbing tendencies that's happening with the rise of socialism is this knee-jerk reaction they're having in the EU and in the United Kingdom. And I think it's coming here. And I see conservative blowhards on Fox News, for example, who think the following is a good idea. They think the UK has this good idea where you're going to ban children from using social media. You're going to ban them. So the proposal in the UK, EU, and the UK is under three can't use a cell phone. Nobody can be on the internet. If you're under three, if you're between 3 and 15, you can only go to sites approved by the government. And then between 15 and 18, now think of this, between 15 and 18, you can join the armed forces. You can get married. You can buy, you know.
Drive a car.
Yeah, you could do lots of things. You can have babies. But between 15 and 18, you can only go to sites that self-certify themselves to some kind of government agency that they are safe.
Right. This is the country.
So we know what that means.
Right. Yeah. This is the country that won't let you pray outside
right.
an abortion clinic.
Right. So if you want to talk about real.
I wonder what's going to get filtered into their approved sites.
What is safe to them would be whatever the political philosophy is.
On either side.
That's in power at that time.
To me, that distinction is irrelevant. But if you give the government control over what your kids can have access to in information wise,
yeah,
that's disaster.
You're not on top of it as a parent.
Yeah.
If you're relying on some kind of law that the workarounds, I mean, children are very clever. But I don't know how, what verification, if I pick up a cell phone and it belongs to, you know, Bobby Jones over there, and he gives me a cell phone and I just start using his cell phone, what verification system exists to tell them how old I am?
I imagine you could do something like have the screen recognize your face. I imagine you could do something like, just ratchet up the penalties.
Right.
I mean, we do this for other things.
So I take my dad's picture and put it in front of the phone?
Yeah, that's right. You can maybe do something like that. Yeah. Or maybe it verifies in real, they'll develop the technology to police it.
Yeah.
You know, we do
and that in itself similar. Is scary.
That's scary, right?
Yeah.
So we do something similar already. You can't go buy a Playboy magazine until you're, 18 or 20? Yeah. I don't even know what the age is.
Yeah. I don't even know if they publish Playboy anymore.
I don't think they do. But yeah. Maybe all the good ones are still there.
No, yeah, right, is yeah, that right? Yeah.
But you can't watch porn. You can't go buy porn, but you can watch it ubiquitously on the internet. So I don't know what the technology would be. Again, I would just ask rhetorically, what could possibly go wrong with this?
Right, right.
I love Thomas Sowell, and as he always says, these programs are hardly ever judged by what their intent is, but
yeah.
Or only they are hardly ever judged by what the outcome is, only what their intent is.
Yeah,
the intent is to protect kids. We want to make sure kids don't get access to this dangerous stuff that's going to cause them to go off the rails and maybe radicalize them or whatever. But that's not how it's going to get implemented, and that's not where even unintentionally.
It's almost as old as Aesop's fables or you know, you go back to Benjamin Franklin or Chaucer. But the path to hell is paved with good intentions, mm-hmm. and it's just it's a human characteristic. So, you know, if we assume that, oh yeah, there's a bad list and a good list of websites and social media, then in you conclude. I just heard on 610, the local AM station coming into the show today, Steve. There's law firms that are trolling for people who want to claim social media has destroyed their lives. They're overeating. They have body image problems. They're addicted to some kind of thing. They're suicidal and they're looking for clients. So, you know, call this number or text to blah, blah, and tell us your story because we're going to do what they did in Arizona or California. We're going to sue social media. So, people are looking for some kind of solution to their personality problems or whatever it is.
Well, allow me to retort, though.
All right.
So the lawyers are looking for clients. Look, I hate lawyers. I am a lawyer, and I get it. I understand all. Like, first kill all the lawyers, right? That's what they always say.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, but it's a market force. If people are getting sued successfully, then that will change conduct. It will, you know, there's going to be a cost benefit analysis. There's going to have to be some sort of they call it law and economics, where what's the, if we fix this or not, but that will move the market. And I would at least rather have that than a government crackdown on what we have access to on the internet.
The problem I have, Steve, just sidebar here,
no pun
before I get to my main point, but the problem I have is like the failed McDonald's fatty lawsuits where they said, well, the hamburgers are addictive in nature. Like, you know, they're so good, so tasty that my 350 or 400 pound client here could not resist having Big Macs, two or three Big Macs a day. And so McDonald's is a reason for his poor health. And so they're making a similar claim with social media that it's designed to be addictive. Well, hell yes, it's designed to be addictive. Like, what business doesn't want to addict, if you will, addict is a strong word, but what, so Shell gasoline, right, is a quality gasoline, let's say Shell or let's say Sunoco, what, pick your brand. And they advertise all the time about, you know, more power for your engine, more will clean, you know, your combustion chamber, whatever. And so they try to addict you to using their gas, you know, and they use all kinds of ploys, you know, hey, join our little club and you get 5 cents off per gallon. Or Kroger, you know, hey, we have the best fried chicken at our deli, you know, so come in and eat, you know, eat our fried chicken as opposed to, you know, the Colonel's. What business doesn't want its customers to become loyal? And if you want to call that an addiction, call it that. I don't care.
Well, all I can say is the first word you said was failed lawsuit.
Failed lawsuit with right. that McDonald's.
So it failed.
Yeah. Now, a few, now in particular cases where, you know, social media, you know, I think there was that case in Arizona is a good case where it was pointed out that there were lack of guardrails, lack of checks and balances, and that school children had access to certain things in school. They were being promoted and, you know, and then when they logged on, they saw things. Well, that's different. Okay, that's an actual failure to contain it during a program that's being promoted by social media. They simply didn't do their job, and I get that. But to just say that social media in and of itself is addictive, well, you know,
to me, the
Faygo orange soda.
Fair enough. You know, I don't
might
know.
Be addictive.
I don't know the cause of action that they're seeking. So there's nuance to this.
Yeah. Well, they're probably typically, trying to figure it out.
Typically,
they're getting clients.
A successful cause of action, I would think, would have to have baked into it some accusation of fraud, where it's advertised as this, but really behind the scenes they're doing this.
Right.
So parents, don't worry. We're going to teach your kid to read. Right. But underneath all this, we're indoctrinating with some other nonsense.
And data mining.
Data mining.
On these children.
Yeah, so stuff like that, you know, that's a different story.
That's legit.
Or you've got the kid in Florida who I think he committed suicide based on an AI bot encouraging it.
Right. How do I commit suicide? Oh, here's some great suggestions.
Right. I think it's a great idea. You should do it because life is horrible.
Right.
And, so I, you know, somewhere in the middle, that's why I don't think, maybe I'll put it this way. The alternative to those kind of lawsuits would be another government regulation prohibiting those types of lawsuits. Or you could just have the system smoke it out. So the McDonald's lawsuit was a failed lawsuit. If they didn't succeed, if a jury didn't say, we're going to give you this award, well, then it fails and it sends the lawyers in a different direction.
Yeah.
And it's what it's imperfect. But it does move.
Yeah, progress. I'm not against the idea that somebody can sue. What I'm troubled by is obviously the concept that would occur to somebody that it's somebody else's fault. I'm the parent of my children, and now they're grown and gone now. But at the time I took control of their access to the internet. You know, I didn't get them cell phones until they reached an appropriate age. The computer was kept in the open area of the house.
Yep.
So the kitchen. So, you know, they're not going to be able to log on to a pornography or something malevolent without mother and father seeing it.
Well, and I think you've cut to the core of this problem is that the government is not your parent.
No.
And the government can't do that job better than your parents.
That's exactly right.
And more and more and more of this stuff has a theme behind it, which is we need governmental intervention in kids' lives.
Yeah, it's part of the socialism.
Yeah, and part of Marxism and socialism is to destroy, a published part of Marxism is to destroy the family unit because it is patently inconsistent with what they want to do, which is a government control over everything.
Right. And what really disturbs me about a lot of conservatives, and this goes back to the greatest generation, your George Bush seniors, your Bob Doles, and, you know, President Trump suffers from this. He's not really a movement conservative. And he and others like him, you know, including, you know, former Republican leaders coming out of World War II, is that, well, the government can solve anything. We put a man on the moon. We landed at D-Day. We took out Tojo and Hitler. You know, I'm like, you know,
forget about the 15 years before that, where FDR basically absolutely torpedoed the economy with this kind of control.
That's right, and it's been downhill ever since. And And the rise of the executive power in the United States is very disturbing to me. I grit my teeth every time Trump issues another executive action because, I mean, that's what Obama did too.
And
I don't like that. You know, I would rather have debate. Yeah, it's slow. It happens in the Senate and the House of Representatives. But, you know, I'd rather have it that way than the EPA just willy-nilly, you know, oh, we're going to close comments on data centers because we're getting feedback we don't like. So let's shorten up the federal, you know, the notice of pending federal.
By executive order.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
These presidents are changing your shower heads.
Yeah, and light bulbs and toilets.
It's lunacy.
It's lunacy.
Lunacy.
It is. So we should talk a little bit, I think, Steve, about ICE. This brings in your legal expertise. Just, you know, what's happened in the last week. There were two fatal shootings involving a vehicle stops.
Yep.
By ICE, one down in Texas and one in Maine. In both cases, they were, my understanding, pending further clarification because ongoing, I mean, it's very fresh. So investigations by the FBI are taking place. My understanding is, though, the raw fact in both cases were one in Texas was an attempted ramming, if that's true. And in Maine, it was an attempted getaway after the stop where, you know, he was under the control of ICE agents and then he just decided to leave. And in both cases, these were illegals with orders to deport. And from what I understand, the reason ICE likes to use vehicle stops is because they don't need a warrant. They like to go into the home. They can isolate the person, you know, because they're by themselves typically, hopefully not with a child in the car, but they can get them going to work or going to do
an
errand.
It's in public, right? It's yeah.
Yeah. And usually they're not going to have a weapon with them if you're lucky, because in the house, right, somebody knocks on the door, right, you get the shotgun out of the closet.
Yeah, look, I mean, to me, this is all about what are alternatives and how did we get to this spot? If we had cooperation up and down the governmental entities,
yeah,
all the way down to the local village, all the way up to the federal government, if we had cooperation,
right,
there would be less of this.
Yeah,
because then there would be, you know, when people here unlawfully got in trouble, they would never get out of jail.
Yeah,
you know, and that the safest place for ICE to do its job is in a local jail.
Yeah. Right.
Or prison.
Then you don't even have the vehicle stopped.
You have nothing.
Yeah. Right?
It's the safest, easiest way.
Right.
If somebody enters the system charged with a crime and they are here unlawfully and they get held, ICE comes and gets them, nobody gets shot. End of story.
Right.
But if you don't, if there are cities, if there are places, if there are
Oh, for
entities,
God's sakes, judges that judges, let the person out the side door.
Who won't do it, then it pushes this all into the streets. Now, they would say, of course, well, we just don't want ICE doing anything. And I'm like, okay, well.
Yeah, change the law then.
Yeah, you know, change the law, change the rules, do whatever. But ICE is doing this, and you by not cooperating with this are really creating a safety hazard. So
that is absolutely,
you know, when you harbor criminals, bad things happen.
Right. You're making it less safe for the illegals.
And for your entire city, everybody around the public.
Everybody around there. Yeah.
So, look, I mean, it's, this is, But it looks good, you know. I'm making my political point.
So some interesting stats. So you had Tom Homan, who's the border czar, was, you know, responding to these two incidents, and they're going to, they put a temporary halt on vehicle stops by ICE. In most cases, they're putting a halt on it until they can assess: are their training procedures okay? Are the rules of engagement clear? And then he expects them to go back to doing vehicle stops, but they're going to take a pause to examine their process and their procedures, which I think is prudent. He also gave a couple statistics, which I think are interesting. So Trump has been president for roughly 16 months, Okay. Which it seems like a longer, well, okay. A little longer, 18 months. So it seems like he's been in office longer, but in the first 16 months, so that would take us through the end of April of this year, there have been over 800,000 illegals have been removed from the country. So probably by now, about 1 million. Mm-hmm. As of the end of April, 641,000 arrested by ICE in 16 months. So those are...
Is that in addition to or...
Well, some of those 800,000 that have been removed, they didn't need to arrest. Some were voluntary. Remember, I think there still is in place a stipend that if you contact ICE and say, hey, you know what, I overstayed my education visa and I'm going to go back to England, they'll give you, I forget what it is, like $2,500, and they'll cover your plane fare to get you back out. So I believe that still exists, that you know, you can actually get a little money on your way out the door if you do it voluntarily.
Yep.
And you're allowed to therefore to also reapply to come back. Whereas if they arrest you and there's an order for you to be deported,
That's it. Yeah.
You're not eligible.
You have to change your name.
Right. So I thought those were interesting. We're back at war with Iran, 6 straight nights of attacks.
It's almost like we predicted that this might happen.
Yes, we advocated, let's just get this done.
And it's almost like the memorandum of understanding was sort of calculated to be a do-over. So you got a new 60 days.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe we heard that here at Common Sense Ohio.
I think the Iranians calculated that Trump was afraid to go back to kinetic war because of the pending midterms. But I don't think Trump thinks like that.
I don't think he does. And I don't think it's going to impact the midterms the way it might have had the way it was going. I think there was a shade on that wasn't so good.
Yeah.
I like this play, actually. I think, and we talked about it here.
Yeah.
Look, there's a memorandum of understanding. It's very generous.
Yeah, right.
All you got to do is follow it.
Yeah.
We tried, guys. Look, we gave them every opportunity to not do these things, to not shoot at us in the straits.
Right.
And shoot at other world ships in the straits.
Right.
And they won't stop.
Yeah.
So now we have no choice.
What are we supposed to do?
Like, we tried.
Yeah.
We tried.
So
it's game on.
With the
and hopefully in short order.
There's been a re-imposition then of the blockade. So it's not just the kinetic part, but now actually the United States Navy is going to prevent any Iranian shipments going in or out. You know, other nations can, you know, we're letting, obviously, other nations can go in and out, but if their intended port is Iran? No.
Yeah. Anything that benefits Iran,
it's not going in.
It's
or
not
out.
Going in or out.
I mean, it's
that's it. That's a stranglehold.
That's a stranglehold. So, I don't know how much longer it's going to last, but pretty
well.
Incredible.
What I hope, look, Iran's going to come to the table with a bunch of false nonsense, and hopefully this time it doesn't work. You know, let's just get the job done.
Yeah. Right.
Just get the job done.
Yeah, just
whether you agreed with being there or not, whether you agreed that we should have been there, or not, now we have to get the job done.
Well, and maybe just like back when we installed the Shah, and you know the CIA arranged for the original, you know, Islamic fascists to be put out of office, and in the CIA, and in fact, it was Norman Schwarzkopf's father who was working for the OS Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the CIA, who helped engineer the installation of the Shah of Iran. And maybe it's time for us to cede with weapons and with support we probably are. Yeah, I mean, I'm probably talking about something that the CIA is doing.
Yep.
I would think.
I would imagine we've got some invisible hand behind this.
Because really, Steve, the fix is, as it always is, the fix is to change the people. You know, like we didn't bomb Venezuela into submission. We got Maduro out, and now Venezuela is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it was a different. That's a different scenario, though.
Different scenario, yeah. But I think Trump was hoping that the native population. Unfortunately, I think the mullahs killed off too many of the protesters.
I think they were short sighted. That's not the right word. I think they were naive in that regard. I think
that there would be an uprising.
Yeah, yeah. Because he actually said it in one of the clips I heard. They don't have guns.
What are they supposed to do?
And the government does.
And they do.
They're not going to keep coming out.
And they'll use them.
And the government will shoot them. They'll shoot its own people.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the means to do it.
I guess the outward signs that there is something going on there is that women are not wearing their burqas. In large numbers,
right?
In Iran. Yeah. So social media, you know, they allowed something the mullahs did is they restored people's access to the internet, I think about a month and a half ago. And so some of the social media posts show young women but large numbers of women are in Tehran and they're not wearing headgear at all. And that used to get you a beating.
Yeah. Well, worse.
But I don't think the IRGC is as nearly as powerful. And the women seem to be making a statement. Like, frankly, a lot of women lead the way, you know, in social change. And I think these Iranian women are being very brave right now by basically saying, hey, we want to go back to a secular culture where if I want to wear a burqa, because I'm a very orthodox type of Islam, fine. But if I don't, I don't have to wear one.
That is the point. If it is what everybody wanted, they will do it.
Yeah,
they will do it.
Right.
If people want to incorporate religion in their day-to-day lives such that they don't go out in a certain way, they don't act in a certain way, they don't do these things in a certain way, then they will do it.
Right.
They will do it. And the government should not have to enforce it.
Yeah, and they just don't want the freedom in Iran. You know, they want to control people. Mm-hmm. It's a religious, you know, state in every way. What do you think about this daylight savings becoming permanent? So it passed the House in Washington. And Thune, the leader of the Senate, says he's in favor of it. And so if it passes the Senate, unless Trump vetoes it, we'll have permanent daylight savings with the option for states to opt out.
Yeah.
So like in Indiana, in January, they say daylight savings would make, you wouldn't have sunrise until 9 o'clock in the morning in Indianapolis. But I'll tell you what, Steve, when I come back to my house after a day of work at 5 o'clock and it's pitch black in January, that is totally depressing to me.
It's very depressing. So I just did a quick search. It was first adopted on a large scale by Germany and Austria-Hungary in 1916 to conserve coal during World War I. Its conceptual roots trace back to New Zealand entomologist George Hudson, 1895. And British builder William Willett, who sought to maximize evening sunlight. In 1784, Ben Franklin casually and jokingly suggested that the Parisians could save on candle usage by rising earlier with the sun. 1908, Port Arthur, now Thunder Bay, Canada, Ontario, first city in the world to implement it. 1918, following Europe's lead, U.S. enacted the Standard Time Act. 1942, during World War II, Roosevelt initiated year-round daylight savings, wartime. Lasted until 45. 66, the Uniform Time Act passed. 73 to 74, we implemented a year-round daylight savings time during the energy crisis in 2007.
And the mothers threw a fit.
Yeah, because the kids were dark.
And that got thrown out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Energy policy of 2005 took effect in 2007, extending the duration of daylight savings time by several weeks, resulting in the modern schedule observed today.
Yeah. So I think it's crazy for Indiana to be on the same time zone as New York. Like they probably should go to Central Time. Yeah. That would resolve that.
That might resolve that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm in favor of it. I would like it to be permanent, but for Ohio And other states can decide whatever they want. That just, you know, it doesn't bother me.
That's how it should be. Good and bad.
Well, just one other bit of Ohio news that I think you might even jump in here. So a U.S. District Court judge yesterday blocked DeWine's Senate Bill 56 prohibition on hemp-infused drinks being able to be sold outside of dispensaries. So there were 10 breweries of hemp-infused drinks that sued in federal court to stop Ohio law on that, Senate Bill 56. And a preliminary injunction was granted yesterday in federal district court. So it'll get sorted out. But I find that I'm not a big DeWine fan. So anything that frustrates him, frankly, gives me a slight jolly.
Yeah.
But I don't know what is the right decision here. I'll be honest. I mean, look, I haven't studied it.
I haven't either. A temporary blocked enforcement of Ohio's Senate Bill 56 regarding hemp-derived THC drinks.
Yes.
I want to know what a hemp-derived THC drink is because I have not researched this. So is this an intoxicating beverage? Is this sort of a...
I had one accidentally.
An herbal beverage is it intoxicating?
I was in a Canadian bar last year and I ordered some kind of cider. And I just thought, well, peach or pear or apple cider, whatever it was. And the guy next to me elbows me and he says, well, you know, that's got THC in it. I had no idea.
I don't know. So hemp-derived THC. So is this because there's different strains of this stuff.
Oh, well,
you know, like we got the Delta 6, Delta 8, Delta 7, all this.
And so, I know nothing about it.
So I'm presuming these are intoxicating beverages on some level. And what I don't like is...
Well, it was mixed with cider, Steve. I can tell you that. So it was combination. It had alcohol and THC.
Well, I think what they're talking about here are just THC drinks.
Okay.
And... What I don't like is the government taking over a certain an industry that probably should be private. So if only the government can sell you your THC.
Oh, drinks. I see. Because DeWine says it's okay to buy it in a dispensary.
That's right.
Yeah, that is a really strong point. Yeah, like if we're going to license dispensaries to sell this, then why can't I buy it at a 7-Eleven?
Yeah, or make it myself and sell it, right? So this is like,
follow you.
And we have the same problem with liquor. Liquor is treated uniquely too. And, some of this stuff just has the history of it. But if you're going to prevent, in Ohio here, we had a long time where you had to go to a state liquor store to buy liquor.
Yeah, right.
It's a little bit.
Franchises that were actually
preferred by the state.
You had to apply to be, it's kind of like, from what I understand, like little hardware stores used to have a post office in them and they would actually be a franchise.
Yeah.
Like you had to apply to be a post office. And it was kind of like that for our liquor stores.
And I remember going down in college for spring break to Florida and you'd see ABC liquor. What the hell is that? I can go buy liquor here. It's not a state store.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're on every corner.
And they're on every corner. Yeah.
Yeah, my winner is AC/DC. They're playing in Columbus, Ohio tonight at Ohio Stadium. And I'll say it was an honor because the lead singer for that band, Brian Johnson, who replaced,
Bon Scott.
Yeah, Bon Scott. One of the Young brothers, Malcolm Young, suffered and died from brain disease, progressive brain disease. And Brian Johnson has ever since then been very active in raising money for charities and putting on events. So I met him at one of those events. It happened to be a race in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I won the damn race. And part of that was being able to meet Brian Johnson. Great guy, foul mouth, super singer. Just incredibly fun guy to be around.
Yeah.
A real pisser. And I'm sure everybody who goes, I hear they're going to play 21 different.
They cranked out hit after hit after hit after hit after hit.
I mean, they're going to do Hell's Bells and Dirty Deeds. They're going to do it all tonight. Yeah.
No, so that's all right. Right here.
That's my
in
winner.
The shoe. So look, inflation is down, it turns out.
Okay.
Year inflation fell for the first time, dropping down to 3.5%. What I'm not seeing is any of this sort of in the media. But it looks like inflation is down. So I guess that's my only winner.
You know, my
and Lindsey Graham, of course, is a something we should talk about. He's both a winner. It sucks that he died.
Yeah.
You know what? Here's my loser.
Yeah.
All these idiots sort of celebrating his death.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's crazy. Even
that was my loser.
That's your loser. I got you.
Yeah. But I mean, explain that, Steve, because there's something really malevolent about a society where instead of addressing what you disagree policy wise with Lindsey Graham, we're getting to the point that when Charlie Kirk is killed, or somebody on Rob Reiner was assassinated by his son, and you had some people on the right go, good, now we got rid of Rob Reiner. Well, or no. Good, we killed Charlie Kirk. Good. What is wrong with people, man?
You know, it's so interesting. Here's another parallel. I happen to be reading Shogun. You ever read Shogun?
James Cromwell's Shogun? I have not read it, but I saw the movie.
It's a book that
thick. Yes, it is.
And I happen to be reading it. And what's interesting to me is, you know, and there's some, even back then when he wrote it, there's some digs at Western society. Like he's injecting some political stuff, I think.
Yeah.
But what is apparent is the Japanese feudal culture had a completely different viewpoint on human life. And in fact, they didn't understand, according to the book, why we Westerners were so obsessed or we celebrated life. Like, we wanted people to live. Like, we wouldn't kill our enemies. And the Japanese in that culture would kill themselves, like, as an honor.
Sure.
And when, if you died, you died. No big deal. You just die. But we celebrate life as in our
Judeo-Christian
background. We celebrate life
with
love, right? So,
right.
You know, with love, all things, you know, we celebrate life. And I don't have to like what you stand for, Norm. I don't have to like what your opinions are. Right. And in fact, I may not like them at all.
Right.
And I may not even like you as a person. But when we as Christians talk about love, what we're saying is we think that you too were made in the image of God.
Yeah.
And your life is therefore important.
Absolutely.
And precious.
Yeah.
And it's sad when you die.
Yeah.
And that's why we don't take other people's lives.
Yeah.
And these people are celebrating that.
Because Christians believe in redemption right up until the last breath.
And maybe even after, we don't know. But that's, you know, who knows what Christ is going to do for us when we're in that sort of transition as it's happening, even in the moment. But my point is that we celebrate life.
Yeah.
And
because somehow, while you're still living, you still have a chance at eternal life with the Father in heaven. And that may sound hokey to people who don't believe that there's an afterlife and don't believe in Christianity, but think of our culture, what it would be like if you didn't control your actions while you're living, because you think that, well, when I die, it's just a dirt nap. I might as well just go ahead and steal and rob and rape and murder and do whatever I want.
Well, interesting.
Because it doesn't matter.
So here's the other point, that maybe the counterpoint to what I'm saying is the Japanese in that culture lived honorably. So they did have a code. And part of the code, if you don't follow it, you die.
Yeah.
They kill you. Like, right. But we don't have that. You can still screw up in this life.
Right.
And you don't need to die for it.
Right.
You can still do things that are contrary to our, quote, code. And you don't need to die for it.
Yeah. The samurai code, for example, I hear where you're going here. So you had Japanese soldiers in World War II that the most dishonorable thing they could do was not to die in combat and fail. Like, you know, okay, you didn't stop the Marines on Guadalcanal or on Iwo Jima. You failed. You didn't, you know, but that is a tactical failure. The greater failure would be for you to surrender.
Yeah. And
like, it's better to die.
Better to die.
Better to die.
We don't see that.
The Americans, you know, you talk about the Bataan Death March. The Bataan Death March was where Americans, we had a general who in the Philippines said, well, I can't just sit here and watch them progressively kill off all of my army. So I'm going to go ahead and surrender. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese mistreated, in part, they were going to mistreat them anyway, but in part, their cruelty and mistreatment was because in their culture, what that general had done was so
dishonorable.
Dishonorable.
Yeah. But we don't see that. And this is why it bothers me when people celebrate the death of somebody else. Like even your worst enemy, even the most evil guy. I mean, you sort of think to yourself, that sucks.
Yeah.
Maybe it sucks that he had to die for that, or it sucks that this happened, or it sucks that he lived that way. Maybe we could have, you know, whatever it is. And we could get in a debate about whether the death penalty, like all that, but that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
I'm talking about a senator who clearly loved the country, disagreed with lots of you out there.
Yeah.
And now there's a celebration. They like ding dong, the witch is dead. That's how they're asking. Yeah. That's how they're treating it. And they mean it. That's what's so bizarre. You, Mangione killing an insurance executive, and he means it. People are happy for it. People, they mean it. They're not just saying it like sarcastically amongst their friends. No. They mean it.
Yeah, that's a tactic. And like Charlie that's Kirk how we'll dead. Change the world is by killing people.
Charlie Kirk is dead, and that's awesome. And they mean it. Like F him, he was a terrible person, so he deserved to die. And I just don't think that about anybody.
There is a happy twist to my little tale about that general who, with army approval, surrendered. He was on the deck of the Missouri when the Japanese surrendered.
Ah, that's interesting. Yep.
They, you know, they had they got him out of the prison camp, put him on the deck, and MacArthur said, "You're going to be here. You're an honored guest." And you know, and he's staring down these Japanese politicians that signed the surrender on the deck of the Missouri. So,
well, with that, we will wrap it up. This has been another riveting episode of Common Sense Ohio, July 15, 2026, brought to you by Harper Plus and coming at you right from the middle each and every week.